Gambling with an Edge, with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is one of the most popular guests on our show, attorney Bob Nersessian. Bob has a brand new book out called The Law for Gamblers that's been promised to us for quite some time. Now, though, there'll be some other questions raised, but mostly we'll be talking about the new book. Bob Nersessian, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Hi, thank you.
Why don't you spend 8-10 minutes, Bob Nersessian, telling us about this book and who the audience is for the book?
Hopefully the audience are everybody who bought Grisham's last book.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that was...
And Stephen King.
And Stephen King combined, yeah, sure. And throw in the guy who
Daniel Steele does okay, too, on that
game. Red October in there, yeah. And Tom Clancy, yeah, I'll take those. But seriously, the audience for the book is much more varied than originally you might think. We're hoping to get some academic sales, a lot of library sales. Obviously, anybody who gambles with any intensity should have this book.
I agree.
And frankly, every casino in the world should buy this book for every one of their employees so they understand exactly what's at risk and where they're messing around with fire, if you will.
Casino, spending money on a book. What a concept.
Well, if you pass it out amongst all the executives, it should only set you back a few thousand dollars, hopefully, if you're that big. No, seriously, it would behoove a casino to have, especially their game protection personnel.
Well, and their security. I mean, that's where they lose a lot of money. To you, is, you know.
Well, from your mouth to God's ears, Richard. I'm really hopeful for some sales to academia because, hell, it's all about patting yourself on the back, and if I can get into one or two classrooms, that's pretty cool. And I'm apparently already getting there a little bit as a little side story. My daughter calls me from Washington, D.C., where she's living and working now. And she tells me, I just got a text from somebody at, I think, DePaul in their law school. And her text was, the professor is talking about your dad. And it turned out to be true. He was. So,
was some of the stuff he was saying about you true?
The question is whether it was good or bad. Okay. It mostly related to, yeah, there's a guy out there named Nersessian who's doing all of these things and driving us crazy or something like that. Well, I'm driving him crazy for a reason. So I like to think that I have a little bit of a homespun ability when I write, although people generally accuse me of... Just from my vocabulary being an arrogant son of a you-know-what or whatever, and I don't mean for that to be the case, and I think I've certainly kept this at a level where the average person would find it very interesting to read. And I would suggest, and this isn't the place to put it out there, but somebody who is unfamiliar with gambling and the law could pick up this book and read it, and this would be an opportunity for them to actually learn something entirely new and put it in their quiver, if you will, where they didn't have a way of even doing that before other than going out and getting experience. And experience can be a lot more expensive than the price of this book.
All right, so let's ask you some questions about specifics in the book. On the issue of patron disputes with the casinos, you argue that in Nevada, at least, the Gaming Control Board has a bias in favor of casinos. Further, you argue that if a player has a case in front of the Gaming Control Board, you better have a good lawyer present with you. Disregarding the built-in self-interest you have in making such an argument, why should a player hire an attorney at $300 an hour or more if you have a dispute with the casino?
Well, first of all, the player can evaluate whether or not there's a contingent fee basis in there and not have to go out of pocket that $300 or more an hour. But the history of patron disputes before the Gaming Control Board shows that you need a number of things to succeed. One, you need to have a record. The record is the proceedings. And if, and a lawyer can build that record to corner both the hearing officer and the casino in the proper case to live up to the deal that they've made, and you should either win that patron dispute out of fear for appeal or just out of simple justice. But there are examples in the book where hearing officers have taken incredibly strange positions in order to hold for a casino. For example, once a come-out bet is up on a craps layout, they have held that that is the value of that come-out bet sitting up there is exactly even to the number of chips sitting in that come-out spot.
After the first roll is
happened?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay? This is the kind of thing I'm talking about. Another one that's in the book, for example, is a guy who bought NASCAR matchups, which is two NASCAR racers racing against each other. It was for Daytona, so the final field for the Daytona 500 did not necessarily rely on qualifying, but the event was called qualifying matchups, and the event date was the date of qualifying. Okay? So, after the fact, or after he had bought the bet, he noticed that the payoff was going to be based on the final lineup, not how these people were driving against each other, at least by what the rules of the casino were. So he went back to the casino and said, all right, how do you want to treat this? Am I playing on the day that you say the event is, or am I playing against the final field? Because I'll tell you right now, if it's the latter, I'm going to wager everything because I already pretty well know how that final field's going to work out because that's based on points. And he was actually giving the casino an out. The casino said, we'll figure that out later, and no, you can't have your money back. Turns out he wins in his qualifying matchups on the date of the event printed on the ticket, and the hearing officer says, nope. You lose on the date of the lineup, which was in on their rules sheet. You don't get paid your higher wagers. So ask me, does that mean that there's a bias or not a bias with them? I don't know, but certainly I think the implication is there. And having a lawyer on your side, in that case I failed, by the way, but having a lawyer on your side can certainly up your odds. And I would suggest that in an appeal, what I just described would have had to have been reversed.
But it wasn't appealed?
No. On a $3,500 payoff somewhere, that cost-benefit analysis wins.
So if you have a hearing with the Gaming Control Board and then you do want an appeal, does it go to a real court or are you stuck with them for the whole process?
The process is unwieldy. First, you do a patron dispute where an investigator with the enforcement division investigates it. That's step one. You get a decision. Okay? Now, either you or the casino can appeal that decision or put that decision at issue in a patron dispute hearing, which is heard by a hearing examiner or hearing officer. He issues a decision anew. Okay. Then after that, you can go to, you can say to the board, your hearing officer was wrong, and you get a hearing in front of the board. Then after that, I believe now with our new Court of Appeals, that gets appealed to the Court of Appeals, and after that, that gets appealed to the Nevada Supreme Court. So when I say unwieldy, I mean they now have implicated effectively a 5 or 6 step process on a final decision in patron disputes.
Chapter 8 of your book is on Indian gaming. Your first two sentences say, Indian casinos have a license to steal. It's just that simple.
You don't want to tell them the title of the chapter?
I didn't write it down. It's not in my notes. Would you like to tell us the title of the chapter? It's
Indian Gaming OMG WTF.
That's a good title. Okay. This chapter ends with your recommendation that a player should stay away from Indian casinos with the statement, once he is on the reservation, he is certainly off the reservation. Now, that sounds to me like a clever line, but I don't know what it means. Why do you say that?
We all live in our society. We're familiar with our society. We're familiar with the systems of justice and what we all do every day to move through the day in a way that is consistent with our social contract. That's our reservation. When you're playing at an Indian casino, you're not there anymore. The social contract is nowhere near as strong as it was beforehand. Look at this. Another example from the book, the Coushatta Indian tribe, something like 678 people in Mississippi who have an Indian casino that has floor space larger than the M. Okay? And now you have a dispute with that casino. The court you go to is made up of the people, that 678 people who already have an interest adverse to you, that is keeping the money that you laid out there, are the ones who decide the issue. So what are your odds? And that's being off of our reservation and on theirs. I'm not saying I don't like Indians. I love Indians. But Indian gaming is its own very special little subculture. They have something called sovereign immunity, which allows them to go off in these odd directions where the deck is ordinarily stacked against you. Another example is, I understand Bob Loeb had a misdemeanor trial in front of an Indian casino in southwestern Michigan. I hope I got these facts right. Well, if you're familiar with the case of Einbinder, Sheriff versus Einbinder.
Hole carding.
And the other cases that have held that, 3 cases in the Nevada Supreme Court gaining a view of the dealer's hold card through sloppy dealing is not a crime at any level. Well, this Indian court called it cheating against all the law that was out there. So those are anecdotal examples, but certainly my experience has them fighting tooth and nail, saying you don't get to have something decided because we're an Indian tribe.
But some are better than others, right? I mean, you've been successful in some states, and I mean, some states seem far worse than others. So Arizona, you had a big case, right?
But I was able to find a glitch that took that into the federal system and away from the Indian tribal system. Now, I did have success in the Indian tribal system to the extent that I got the seized money back. But they were looking at something that was, from my perspective, just bare theft. And no matter how skewed your court system might be, you don't get to say, yeah, we took the money, and that's all we have to do. It's ours now.
Now, in California, do they go to – isn't there some deal in California where it goes to normal courts, or do they – or is it Indian courts in California as well?
Indian courts in California as well.
Yeah.
And there's even one of the big issues in front of the Supreme Court right now is if you're dealing with something like Harrah's Rincon, which is a partnership between Harrah's and the Rincon tribe, and the place is managed by Harrah's. It's not a partnership. It's actually managed by Harrah's, and ergo the name.
And it looks like a regular Harrah's property anywhere else.
Can you just sue Harrah's? Most of the law right now says no.
Wow.
Well, just sue Harrah's in ordinary court. Well, most of the law right now says
the tribe probably has more money than Harrah's anyway. So. Okay.
But I have to say, I mean, just for our listeners, that playing in Indian casinos is high risk but high reward, because often some of the best opportunities for advantage players are in Indian casinos.
Yeah.
And, you know, but you just have to be aware that, you know, you may have to fight some battles.
I don't think this is in my book, but it was in an article that discussed this that I gave a comment on not too long ago. It works like heroin. Okay? When an Indian casino takes actions adverse to an advantage gambler and it hits the press, that tells all the APs out there, oh, there's a game somewhere in that casino that is cool. And instead of fleeing from the Indian casino, and I'm not saying whether this is the right choice or the wrong choice, you will see an influx of advantage gamblers towards that casino to find out what the player was playing that caused such consternation from the Indian tribe.
Now, you basically tell players it's best if they don't play there at all, but if they have to play at any casino, be cautious. Now, what kind of caution would you recommend at an Indian casino that you wouldn't recommend at M?
Okay. You're an AP. You find a game. Okay. Don't crush it. That would be one example. Because if you crush it, you may well find yourself in handcuffs in the middle of God's country trying to figure out why, if they put out a game that is paying wrong odds at Sick Bow, I'm sitting here in handcuffs rather than their casino manager getting fired who put the wrong odds on the table. One example. Another, and, you know, obviously everybody has their own proclivities, and a lot of the advantage players I know, to the chagrin of many others I know who want something to be there forever, their plan is always just to crush something as soon as they find out it exists. Take it till it breaks. Well, when you have the break point at an Indian casino, it might be a little more than just being told to leave. And the key example that comes to mind, go read the case you talked about a few moments ago. And in that case, the guys who took those guys in the back room and threw them in handcuffs also grabbed every penny in their pocket.
Well, that's another thing I would say is...
And their plastic donkey.
And their plastic donkey, yeah. But another thing I would say is don't take more money into the casino than you need, you know.
That's a great one, yeah.
Yeah.
Your bankroll is in a bank, not in your pocket.
Yeah. And, yeah, I certainly wouldn't go into one with any kind of fake ID or, you know, players' cards in five different names. I mean, you know, there are a lot of kind of common sense ideas, I think. But now, do you think you're a lot safer in the giant places like Mohegan Sun or Foxwoods than you would be in,
no.
You know? No?
No.
Wow.
I've been on the phone. I can't remember if it's Mohegan Sun or Foxwoods, but I've been on the phone with those casinos while they're holding an AP at the side of the road off of the outside of the casino, and they chased her down in a squad car. All right?
Wow.
And then, if I remember the incident correctly, they got local constables on site, too, and I was on the phone, and I'm pounding the table, sorry about that, and I was able to talk to what I will call the real police, who then looked at the Indian police and said, let her go. You know, she beat your game. Big deal.
You have a chapter on asset forfeiture, which frequently means police of various sorts making a traffic stop and taking your money. Now, we've spoken about this several times on the show. So tonight we're talking about some things we haven't been spoken about quite so frequently. In this general area, we have a question from a listener. Is it legal to videotape or audiotape a police officer in Nevada without notifying him first?
Wow.
We have spoken about it, but it bears repeating.
I got your list of possible questions, and that was on there, and I absolutely forgot to tell you, please don't ask me this question.
No.
No, the general answer is it's pretty well established now that you can videotape or audiotape police officers in the performance of their duties as public servants while they're working as public servants, as long as you do not interfere with their job. You've asked me an impossible question, Bob, because the answer is if it's somebody standing up on the curb with their cell phone out, or even a video recorder, or for God knows how this would happen, a 32 millimeter film.
That might be obvious.
I'm pointing out that it can be obvious, but it shouldn't be hidden. Yeah, you can videotape that incident. If you are the actual subject, I don't have an answer to that, because it may well be that they could term that interference with them doing their job. You are distracting them from what they're doing, and interference with a police officer in the conduct of their duty. You're not exercising really a First Amendment right while you're the subject, or there could be an argument that you're not. So if you're the actual subject and you pull out a camera and then get in the cop's face and are filming yourself doing that, it could be pretty different.
Right, but if you just turn on your recorder and it's sitting in your pocket while the whole thing, you're not breaking any law by recording the conversation with the cop.
In Nevada, there's a statute that the subject of a confidential or the subject of recording is entitled to know they're being recorded. There's really no downside to saying to that cop, you're being recorded, do that. I think you're still probably okay even if you don't, but why risk it, you know?
But if he then demands you turn it off, then you have to turn it off, or?
How would I handle it? I would say, the recorder is in my pocket. It is not interfering with our conversation in any way. You're conducting a Terry stop. If you decide to arrest me, you can do an inventory search and shut my phone off. But until that point, it's there and it's recording you.
There you go. I'll write that down later.
Yeah. I might want to listen to this thing a couple times. All right. New subject. He didn't tell me not to ask him this one either. In the chapter on hiring an attorney to help with your taxes, you say some attorneys and accountants have been known to turn in their own clients.
Oh, yeah, that freaked me out when I read that.
You cited an article in the Los Angeles Times that referred to one unnamed accountant in St. Louis who did this. There's no attorneys mentioned in that article. Surely this has to be very rare, isn't it?
You ask an excellent question.
And what about attorney-client privilege?
Oh, what about it? Okay. I can't shoot you, but if I pull out a gun and put one between your eyes, you're just as dead. Okay? I'm sort of serious when I say that. The attorney-client privilege is all fine and good, but if you're dodging the IRS for $30 million and your attorney knows about it and he goes to the IRS and says, if I get you $15 million, will you keep this confidential and give me 10 of it? What do you think the IRS answer is?
Wow.
Okay. Not all attorneys are, I love attorneys. I married one. But not all attorneys are completely above board. I have some anecdotal information that what I said is true. I have also added to the footnote in the book a circumstance where an attorney did turn and give the IRS the information to the client. It isn't just the one accountant one you read. And now to the more important question that Bob asked, which is, surely this is rare? Surely we don't know. Okay? I hope and pray and even assume it's rare, but I don't know. I anecdotally know of a circumstance where, from what I understood, the IRS actually acknowledged that they had three private CPAs on their payroll for just this purpose at one point.
Wow.
Here's the problem. All of this dates back to the early 80s, or a lot of this dates back to the early 80s when I was a tax attorney. And despite the wonderful and global nature of the internet, trying to redo research or knowledge that you had 30 years ago is not always there.
Okay. Different subject. Assume I have a room in a casino. Maybe comped. Maybe I paid for it. Tell us if that matters. The casino decides I'm a card counter and evicts me from the casino and demands that I vacate the hotel room immediately. Do I have a case against the casino for violating their duty as an innkeeper?
My belief as of today in all 50 states is that you have a cause of action.
Even if it's a comp?
Even if it's a comp, because that one would be a promissory estoppel. You've traveled to that casino and taken up that room on their promise that you would have it. They have now canceled it without a valid reason. And now you have an action in what is called promissory estoppel, and you get your reliance damages on the promise that they breached.
Wow. I mean, because I don't think people know that, because that was certainly a common practice to get barred, especially they love to do it in the middle of the night, you know.
Okay, so you have a cause of action, all right? You lost a room and you spent $300 on airfare to get to Vegas. You can go across the street and get another room for $38 a night. Go find a lawyer, because promissory estoppel is not a tort. Go find a lawyer to sue a casino for your airfare and your two-night stay at $35 a pop.
Okay. There's the rub.
I withdraw the question. This is a true story. Somebody told me of it recently. I don't know if it's on your list.
Wait. Before we move on, could you do it in small claims?
Sure. Are you going to win in small claims?
I don't know.
I don't know. Lawyers like me
are
judges in small claims. Okay?
Then I should win.
How many lawyers are there like you?
If you're counting just regular lawyers out there, who, I don't know. I think we're up to bar number 9,000 or 11,000 something in Nevada, and we're over 150 in California, 150,000. There's a lot of us out there. And we run the full gambit from good to bad, and you don't have to be particularly good to find yourself sitting in small claims court. You don't have to have a broad swath of knowledge. You might be a criminal attorney now hearing civil small claims. I'm not picking on lawyers. We do our darndest to know as much as we can and work as hard as we can. And I would suggest that 99.9% of us do not turn in our clients to the IRS.
I would hope not.
So, but, you know, are you going to win? You can bring the claim. My personal feeling is you should win and you should get your reliance damages. But in reality, at the end of the day, you win cases you should lose and you lose cases you should win. Mm. And that's for lawyers. What do you think you're going to do?
All right. True story. Happened recently in Vegas. A player earned a bonus of $100 in free play. that had to be placed in his account by a slot club manager. So the supervisor typed in $100.00, but somehow forgot the decimal point, so it ended up as $10,000. When the player went to play it off the next week, he was expecting $140 because there was weekly play in there too, but instead it was $10,040. He played it off in $1,000 increments so as to be able to cash out the tickets at a normal change machine and not having to go to the booth. Ended up less than $10,000, so probably there's no structuring involved. Has this player done anything wrong?
Before I answer that question, I want to ask you, is there going to be a casino or a cop retracing their steps after I give my answer? Because you're not going to like my answer.
I can tell you what the casino did. Would that help you any?
Oh, so this is all out in the open now.
As a story, the casino, he got no mail the next month. He went in to ask why, because he'd been playing his normal
amount.
That's
pretty ballsy right there. After that, to go in and ask why he didn't get mail?
And so they went and they said, this is kind of funny. They had, he had like $200 of free play in his account, a comp's built up. They took his $200, and they figured it was their mistake. They recognized that. So the best way they had to get even was to take his $200 in comps. He no longer had that, but he could play and he could earn mailers in the future. So he's back playing again. He's not would not be an AP. Clearly, they want him as a valuable customer.
Ah,
but they
kudos to the casino, because under different circumstances, if this was not a coveted player, they probably could have gotten a prosecution and a conviction on a felony.
Wow.
This is criminal.
Yeah. Nevada has a statute that says when you receive money that you know is mistakenly given to you, it's essentially the, wow, this ATM is spitting out $100 bills. Do I get to keep them statute? And the answer is no. If you keep them, it's a crime. Same thing. If he knows it's money not earned and mistakenly given, he has a duty to return it, and absent fulfilling that duty and converting that money to his own personal use, he commits a felony.
Wow.
Depending on the value. Some of it won't be a felony, like if it's $80.
What's the cutoff?
I have no idea.
That wasn't on the list.
please give me the...
We got it narrowed down to higher than 80 and less than 10,000, yeah,
right,
though.
So. Right, right.
All right.
So that means if a dealer, if a dealer pays a push and you realize it, then that's a felony? If the bet, you know, say at a $1,000 bet and a dealer paid a push.
Well, that's a little different. I don't want to parse out, or that's a very good question, Richard, because the difference is that they have an obligation to call the game.
Ah.
Okay. It's not a mere mistake. It's a mere mistake in a game. And also with the other thing is, yes, I believe I even discussed this in the book, for example, exactly what you're talking about. Here's something interesting. In the one you just gave and what you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
The casino cannot sue the player to get the money back.
In either of those?
In either. The casino is out the money. The casino can't sue a player for a gambling debt unless it's supported by a credit instrument, i.e. a marker. So they don't have a right to sue players if, even if a cheater walks out with $100,000, they can't sue that player. Okay. Instead, what happens is, excuse me, a prosecution and an order of restitution and possibly jail time. But as to the casino just plain up and suing to get the money back, the casino does not have a right to access courts in Nevada over a gambling debt. They do in New Jersey and many other states, but in Nevada, believe it or not, gambling is, while not necessarily still illegal, it is a public nuisance. And casinos are only operating at the discretion of the state to allow them to not get prosecuted for committing that nuisance.
This might be a related question. I walk through a casino and I see a $20 cash out ticket on the floor. I pick it up. Either I put it in a machine or go cash it. Somehow I keep the money. Has that been a crime?
Generally, the thought is absolutely not on what you described. If you walk by a machine and see the money still in the machine, that is likely not a crime either. That comes under what's called abandoned property. But where it's running into troubles is the person who turns around for a minute to talk to their aunt or puts their chair up against the machine and runs to get a drink at the bar, and a slot walker comes by, pushes out the cash out ticket and takes it, and then when he gets picked up, he tries to say, "Oh, I was just collecting abandoned property." And depending on the circumstances and how ugly the video looks, I think we have a word for that guy, and it's convict.
Okay, different question.
How many you got?
10 more minutes.
Easily, several more. If you're tired, we can do commercials. Are you that tired?
No.
Greektown Casino in Detroit changed ownership recently, and now the group that owns it is called Jack Entertainment. So the casino will be called maybe Jack Detroit. If a player has been 86 at Greektown, read the Trespass Act, does the change in ownership or name mean he's now welcome to go back and play?
Generally, yes. Well, welcome? No.
Yeah.
Is he subject to being arrested for trespass? He may well be arrested for trespass, but I doubt there could be a valid conviction. I don't have the Michigan law in my pocket, but I do know this question recently came up in Nevada. It is on appeal in front of the Nevada Supreme Court as we speak. The district court judge ruled that the trespass statute, first of all, understand, trespass is not a crime unless it's made a crime by statute. Historically, trespass by itself is a civil wrong without a criminal corollary. So, when the Nevada statute 207.200 says that when an owner or occupant gives you a warning not that you must leave and cannot return, you are now trespassed, and if you do return, you commit the statutory crime of trespass. Now, who gave the warning in your Jack case, the Jack Casino? It was somebody totally different from the current owner. So if the Michigan statute is analogous, no, there's no crime there. In Nevada, the district court judge ruled, and I think I got this right, although it may be a different holding company, that a warning from Harrah's Entertainment to not go on any of their properties was ineffective because they don't own any casinos. They own companies that own casinos.
Huh. And Harrah's is appealing that.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Is there a chance that the young woman this is involved has been a guest on this show? Or her husband. Would that be likely?
I don't know. Is it?
I don't think it's who you think it is, Bob.
All right. If it's not who I think it is, then we're going to do commercials.
You're assuming that I've listened to this show beyond when I'm on it.
Yeah.
I have. This is a wonderful show. Everybody should tune into it religiously week after week.
So we're going
to buying my book.
Yeah, right. Two copies. Yes. We're going to do some commercials, and we're going to come back and ask you to tell us about a story that should scare the heck out of every listener about a guy named Glenn Cobb. South Point has more than 10,000 gains, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. Big promotion this month is called the $600,000 March Money Madness. At all times, there's a casino-wide progressive with a value that grows from a reset of $10,000 to whenever it's hit, which it must be hit by $25,000. One lucky player gets the prize, and everybody else with a player's card inserted when it goes off gets $25 in free play. As soon as a jackpot is hit, another progressive begins at $10,000. This will continue all month long. All machines are eligible. An additional minor progressive is always running between $1,000 and $2,500. This progressive is likely to go off about three times a day. Double points are on Thursday, March 17th, if you're wearing green, or even if you're not. The free video poker class this week will be 9-6 Bonus Poker Deluxe. The game is very similar to Jacks or Better, except that it pays more for all four of a kind and less for two pair. At the South Point, you can play it at full value between bets of $1.25 and $50. The return is 99.64% when played well. Slightly positive all month long, including the slot club and progressives, and more positive on the double point day. At the Palms, between now and the end of April, they have drawings every Friday and Saturday night, 7:15, must be present to win. Five winners share $5,000, plus a chance to win $1 million in the Million Dollar Match game. PFP, Play for Prizes. They will begin next Monday, where for 2 weeks you can earn Albertson's gift card. The 2 weeks after that will be cash. Prizes will be redeemed at a rate of 0.20%. You keep the points up to $190 a day. This week through Friday, March 4th, there's no PFP. Instead, every day you get a multiplier at a kiosk, which must be turned into the Club Palms to either Boothling or Box in the Corner. You may earn up to 80,000 bonus points a day, assuming you get a 2x multiplier and play the 80,000 points. This promotion gives you $200 in free play instead of the $160 you would normally earn on gift cards if you were playing on the PFP. Much better, in my opinion. If you get a multiplier of 3x or higher, so much the better. There will also be two multiplier Wednesdays in March, on 16th and 30th. Here, video poker players receive a minimum and maximum of 2x and maximum bonus points of 40,000 points. And on these two multiplier days, it's also eligible for the PFP in addition to the double points. VideoPoker.com is the best place to play a lot of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is called Powerhouse Poker. This is a 10 coin per line game, which comes with sound effects reminiscent of some electrical generator gone slightly amiss. On dealt hands, you get multipliers and additional hands, which vary by game and by number of lines played. There's no change in strategy needed. Compared with the base game, it slightly increases your EV to play this, and it slightly increases the variance. All right, Bob Nersessian, we got about 10 minutes. Tell us about Glenn Cobb and why it should scare the heck out of all of our listeners.
No.
All right, in that case, I have another question.
You'll have to read the book for that.
There's the point. Buy the book. Read all about it. No, seriously, though.
I have other questions.
No, well, I can... I centering on Glenn Cobb, which is discussed in the book and is all public record, and that's where I got it, was in my own independent research. This is not a rare circumstance. This, in my actual practice, I have run into something functionally identical to this two other times. All right? So what we're dealing with, and it just as an aside too, I don't think it's materially different, although I'm not saying that it is exactly the same, as the various prosecutions that have been attempted against Billy Walters. Okay? If you're big and you're a big better and you are very sophisticated and you have put together a consortium or something like that to make wagers, and the government discovers it, they think you're a bookie. They do not have any real recognition about the two sides of the transaction so far as bookmaking statutes are concerned. The example I'll give you is one that comes out of my own family, which was the first time I ran into this, and this goes back to the 1980s. Trying to re-research something from 1985, but a relative of mine who was reputed to have mob connections, I don't know that that was the case, but he was certainly a two-time loser, got picked up on the third time for bookmaking, and he was arrested with, if I can remember this correctly, 32 other people. It was a Detroit, Las Vegas, as the government termed it, connection. Okay? What they were a wagering consortium of gentlemen, and I believe they were all men, who had gotten together. They weren't laying off for other people. They were all invested in it, and they were making bets, and where you make bets is in Vegas. Okay? So they would send out their representative to make bets, and he would make the bets, and then wins, losses would be divided up, what have you. That's not bookmaking. It's not bookmaking within a country mile. But they arrested this relative and the other 32 people, and because of his history, they went after him first. Okay? And because of his history and their deal where, since it was the third time, he wouldn't have to spend the rest of his life in prison, he cut a deal and took a plea. The rest of the people were not as badly situated, and they went after him first and hardest because they were pretty sure that no matter what, they could squeak a plea out of him. It's my opinion. They then tried the case against their strongest case against defendant number two. Jury was out. Jury came back. Gee, government, don't you understand the difference between illegal bookmaking and making a bet? Not guilty. Third trial, same time, same result. After the third trial, 29 people had all charges against them dismissed. It happens all the time, and it is impossible to get into the head of a U.S. attorney and convince them that playing big money on sports can be of a nature which is not illegal.
I know of at least four people who've had the feds come knocking at their door saying, you're making too much money, you can't just be gambling. I mean, yeah, and it's scary. I mean, fortunately for the four people I know that it happened to, they were able to demonstrate that they weren't doing anything illegal, that they were just gambling. You know, but yeah, you can just be committing the crime of being successful, which if you're in a cash business, that's you know, and actually my favorite line from my book, my own cheap plug here, my favorite line from my book is Chip Reese said, just because I'm not doing anything illegal does not mean I won't have to defend myself someday.
I think I've made that clear throughout all my appearances on this show.
Yeah.
I saw from the look on Bob's eyes that he's surprised by what both you and I are saying, I believe.
No, Bob is searching his notes to find another question to ask you until before it lasts. I find listening to you fascinating, Bob, and so I just lost my place in my...
Well, while you're looking, I'll continue on with, I know of the other circumstance that I know of had the government taking over $600,000 when they raided the, the research base for a group of bettors, and rather than get in the fight and everything else, these people just left the country and left the money because that's how successful they were. And nobody was ever prosecuted, but the whole thing was ridiculous because they were bettors and they watched their games. And when the government sees a basement with seven 45-inch TVs in it, they go, wow, look at those TVs. I get one. You get one. We all get a TV.
Okay. All right. We got 2 minutes. In the chapter on Indian gaming, WTF, OMG, or something like that, you said if something happens to a player, he should sue the individual members of the tribe, but not the tribe itself. Do you have a minute and a half answer to that?
The tribe itself will get sovereign immunity. Even in my Arizona case, the tribe had sovereign immunity. The big danger is that when you sue the tribe, the test in federal courts is the money of the tribe at risk in the litigation? When you join the tribe with the individuals who actually committed the torts on behalf of the tribe, then you run the risk of what has happened in many cases where the judge looks at it and says, obviously, this is an attempt to get money out of the tribe. That you can't do in federal court. This is an attempt to skirt that and avoid sovereign immunity because you took that shot. We're going to grant everybody sovereign immunity.
Wow. All right. We want to thank Bob Nersessian and go out and buy his book. The title of it again is
The Law for Gamblers.
Should be out very, very soon. It's already on Amazon.
It's on Amazon.
Pre-order it.
Yes. And some other sites as well, as from what I've seen.
Right. Anyway, we appreciate your questions. You can send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge, or you can tweet them at me at RWM21. If you want the show delivered to you automatically every week while you're sleeping, you can sign up to do that at iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or my site, richardmunchkin.com. And to get an archive of every show that's ever been done, even when I wasn't on it, you can find those at bobdancer.com.
And we've been doing over 5 years of these, which kind of surprised me when I realized that. All right. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Bob Nersessian. Always
you for
a pleasure.
Having me.
Yeah. All right. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.
Views and opinions expressed on this program were those of the hosts and guests and did not necessarily reflect those of Vegas All Net Radio, its affiliates, or its parent company.